And the community is welcome with your family. That is how I interpreted all the years. So I give a bracha again. So your grandchildren can mean the people who were impacted by people that you had a positive effect on. Many of them you don't even know about. You might have been on a train or on a plane with them, and you just smiled, or you made room for them or whatever, and they saw you're a Jewish person. And it had a positive effect on them, and because of that, they had an effect on somebody else. That's your grandchild. So you should all enjoy, in good health, the weddings of your grandchildren. Yeah, but however, I'm not saying you should be like Rip Van Winkle. I say you should enjoy good health and prosperity and simcha and joy in all the intervening stages till you get there. Enjoy everything. Every day is a lifetime. Every day is a beautiful day. Not everything that's happening around us is beautiful. In a general way, and even in our personal lives sometimes. Depends how you look at it. But one thing, if you say, how can I contend with that? What can I do in a positive way? That day becomes a lifetime. We'll talk about that yet. But L'chaim, L'chaim. Now, Rabbi Yaakov Tzvi Zakash, also known as Jonathan Sacks. I actually, I met him when he was an undergraduate in Cambridge. I was the one going to the universities. We had a group went for a Shabbos, Parshas Mishpatim. It's just soon going to be about 55 years, to almost 60 years already. And then we corresponded, and I used to learn with him. I taught him Hasidus. And he was a beautiful young person, and I had a class in Cambridge after he met the Rebbe. Every 2 weeks, every fortnight, they say in England, and I would come an hour earlier and learn with him, and then we would have people came into his every student had their own what they called the rooms, their own little. Place, and we would have anywhere between 2 and 15 students that came, and we discussed the concept from Hasidic teachings. And then he came to Shabbos, and then he met Elaine. It's a whole story. It's a whole. To me, it was one of the earlier students that I met and that I had impact on. And eventually, he had an impact on me. But. So his young adulthood and mine, somehow or another, even though I'm a few years older, coincided with each other, and we were very close till the end. And called me, the last I knew was anyway. I'll share with you first. When he went to the Rebbe, this by that time I already knew him for months. It was 1968, in the summer, and he won a B'nai B'rith scholarship for students to get a $99, 99-day Greyhound bus ticket. I don't know if anybody knows about it. This was a big thing in those days. You paid $99 and you could take the Greyhound bus that summer anywhere over 99 days. It had a begin date and an end date.
Cuba.
And he decided that his project that he won the bid for was to look into Jewish leadership. Not as a leader or a potential leader, but just as a student. And he met Rabbi Soloveitchik. And he met Professor Heschel of the conservative movement, and he met in Cincinnati the Reform, and he met Nochum Goldman in Manhattan, who was from the not religious, secular, but a very big activist for Jewish affairs in the 60s, 70s. And wherever he went, he heard about the Rebbe. And then we arranged that he should be able to have a yechidus, a private audience with the Rebbe. And he had certain questions. And I'll tell you one of them in a moment. But first I'll say, parenthetically, when he became chief rabbi, he was in the School of Philosophy in Caius College, Cambridge. It's a top, one of the, Cambridge has about a couple of dozen colleges in Cambridge University. And he was in a prestigious one. He was a student of philosophy, and he was a first, in other words, the highest level of that. So when he was chosen as chief rabbi, by the way, 2 weeks before he was chosen, before it became public, he phoned me. He said, this is a call for Hakaras HaTov. This is my acknowledgement, a debt of gratitude, because you started me on the path. And so I don't want you to find out from the newspaper. I want you to hear straight from me that I'm going to be the chief rabbi in 2 weeks. And his wife, Elaine, it's another story. I'm still in touch with her occasionally. And he went to the Rebbe with his questions. And then the Rebbe said to him, and the BBC asked him, what made it someone like you with that kind of a career in philosophy become a rabbi? And then eventually became a chief rabbi, but he just became a rabbi first. And he told him about the Rebbe. And how the Rebbe told him one sentence. I heard this from him I don't know how many times in the course of his lifetime. That one sentence of the Rebbe changed his entire perspective on life. What happened was, he asked the Rebbe his questions, and then the Rebbe said, I want to ask you a question. He said, sure. How many Jewish students are there in Cambridge? So he said, 1,000, whatever the number was. And how many are active in the Jewish society? That's like the Hillel, the official Jewish place there. 100 or whatever it was. So the Rebbe asked him, my question is, what do you propose to do to enhance Jewish life in Cambridge for everyone? And he said that sentence suddenly turned his whole entire perspective of Judaism on its head. He was from an observant family. He'd been a yeshiva boy. His father was in the Second World War. He didn't study in any yeshiva, but he was a man who went to shul every morning. I remember his father. And the Rebbe said to him, it's the first time anyone suggested to him that being Jewish is not just a privilege and something that you are a recipient of, but it's something where you're expected to become a producer also, not just a consumer. You're supposed to do something for somebody else. What do you intend to do to enhance Jewish life in Cambridge? That sentence turned his life. By the way, there are a lot of, it's the 50 yard site was now Chav Cheshvan. And there are a lot of books and various studies and special programs and seminars taking place, some of which I know. There's one major big biography which is coming out from an official one, and they have access to all of his private notes. And so one of the team of the year came to my house to interview me for a couple of hours about his Chabad connection. And another one, which is a modern Orthodox publication, but who poo-pooed his Chabad, he quotes for 200 people, so he quotes the Rebbe also, amongst all the other people. But you have to realize, it's not quoting the Rebbe, it's that at about 4 or 5 key moments in his life, when he was at a crossroads, that he consulted the Rebbe and followed what the Rebbe told him to do, including becoming chief rabbi. I saw the letter, and I saw the Rebbe's answer. And Rabbi Krinsky, so Zayin Gesund, Rabbi Krinsky, the Rebbe's secretary, when I told him the story, he said, at that time, when he got that answer, the Rebbe wasn't answering anyone. It was, the Rebbe was giving out dollars on Sundays, but there was very little. He sent you to your rabbi, your Chabad rabbi, personally, and the Rebbe answered it. He said it shows that the Rebbe's orders is important. He gave the Rebbe three choices, and the Rebbe said, choose as chief rabbi, and he said, maybe he's not religious enough, he's not right-wing enough, and the Rebbe said, every Jew always has to move more to the right, become more religious, something to that effect. But it was the Rebbe who told him, in the first place, to become active. As he coined the famous phrase, good leaders create followers. Great leaders create leaders. He said, the Rebbe was a great leader. He wasn't there to make followers. He was there to make people realize. He said, he's a person who knew your potential and made you realize, made you feel the greatness in yourself that you never dreamt was there. It uncovered, learning the Rebbe's teachings, that's what it does for you. It helps bring out your inner depth. And I want to tell you something, which I heard from Professor Yitzhak Block, Olav Hashalom, was a Harvard philosophy professor who the Rebbe told to go to Harvard, and the Rebbe told him to finish it, this was in the 50s yet. And he was a professor in University of Western Ontario in London, Canada, for many years. A very major chassid, Rabbi Mendel Futterfass, no less, told me he's a great chassid as chassidim of 100 years ago. Men were saying 50 years before then. And Rabbi Block wanted to get smicha, become a rabbi, during his own journey. And the Rebbe said, definitely no, underlined. And Yaakov Haneke, Jack Hanoka, he asked the Rebbe, I want to learn to become a rabbi. And the Rebbe said, you will have more influence in the Jewish world with a PhD after your name than with a title of rabbi. These were people who had already spent years, and the Rebbe did not want those years that the person spent before they became religious to be wasted. That was one of the reasons the Rebbe told Hanoka, you're elevating all the years by using it as in a leadership role. So Professor Block told me once an insight. He said, it takes a Rebbe to be able to recognize in Jonathan Sacks, who would have been a brilliant philosophy professor, to recognize that he will do more for Judaism as a rabbi than as a professor. He would have been a big, famous professor somewhere, even if it would be Cambridge or Oxford. Name me one professor of Oxford, anybody here.
Lou.
Name me one professor in Cambridge. You know, one professor in USC. So he did to Yiddishkeit, like it's unbelievable. His non-Jewish following is in the million. They're translating his work, they're talking about it, into Arabic. But he's popular. The Rebbe saw that. So he's not just another person that he quotes. He went to the Rebbe for all major key stages of his life. I'm telling you, I was very, when before he got married, there are certain laws you learn from marriage. I personally learned with him one-on-one. That's, we were extremely close. Extremely close. And his connection with the Rebbe was very deep. The Rebbe wrote comments on his PhD even. Which I have, I made a photocopy of it when he came and showed it to me. Like a handwritten about four or five lines on his PhD, which was on the concept of hachayach techiach, on admonishment within Jewish law and caring for others. Anyway, so let me just tell you a couple of stories about him. There's some I cannot tell, obviously. I'll tell you a few that maybe a lot tell us in our own lives. In that first summer, he went to the Rebbe, and he was a person who was a connoisseur of art and of music, classical music, beautiful music, and literature. He was a real maven. And he asked the Rebbe, is a love for Hasidus and a love for Judaism, which excludes certain areas which are forbidden, certain areas of art or music or literature which we are not allowed to indulge in. You're not supposed to, lo shasur, you mustn't turn after your eyes and after your things, certain things you're not allowed to learn in Judaism for the average person. So there seems to be a contradiction between my innate love of culture, of art, music, and literature, against being a real 100% from Yid. And the Rebbe said to him that the love for Hasidic teachings and the love and the depth and the commitment to Judaism will give you an insight and a dimension that you would never get in art and in music and in literature, in secular art, secular music, secular literature. You will appreciate it in a much deeper level. And that deeper level of appreciation will more than compensate, they'll more than make up for what you're losing out in those areas which are forbidden. It's a fantastic insight, something to live by, about living with all the priorities together. You can have everything, as long as the animal is harnessed to the human. The animal soul, let it enjoy what the Torah allows it on the terms of the Torah, and you'll get it in a much deeper level. The thing, the physical things you have, a physical life, a yid who keeps Shabbos properly. It's a treasure. It's priceless. It's not an enslavement. A person who sees it as enslavement is because they don't appreciate the deeper dimension. But someone who sees the deeper dimension in and so learning Torah, learning the Rebbe's teachings, would give a person an appreciation of their physical life. It'll put it onto a different footing. That's what the Rebbe told him. And it's interesting, because while he was there that summer, he learned a lot. He had three bacharim in 770, who he was. He studied in 770 Eastern Parkway for about a month or for 6 weeks that summer. Later he was in Kfar Chabad Yeshiva for 6 weeks. That was later on. But here, he was there, and Chaim Farrow, who is today a rabbi in Beit Shemesh, he was a bacher, he was a yeshiva student, and he studied with him. And Jonathan said, and he's also from England, and comes from an Orthodox, but a very cultured family. And Jonathan Sacks said, where can I find something like as deep as classical music in this community? And Chaim Farrow told him, the Alter Rebbe's Niggun. He said, can you sing it for me? He said, I'm not allowed to. He said, how can I get access to it? He says, still a wedding coming up at the chasen that they sing it. And he took him to a wedding just so he should learn the Alter Rebbe's Niggun. But it wasn't only that. About a half a year after that, he used to come to my house, we'd learn. Finally, he came for Shabbos. Even when he was married, he came with his wife. Our oldest children, they all knew him very well, as like a regular in the house. But one time, it was during the week, we're sitting in the front room, And out of the blue, he tells me, I remember a snatch of a niggun that I heard at the Rebbe's Fabringen. But I don't know, I don't remember any part of it except one snatch. And he wanted me to fill in the blanks. So I said, what snatch do you remember? So he's sitting there in the front room, chuckling, and he says, ah, ma, ma, ah, na, na, ah, na, 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 ah, na, na, ah, da, 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 da. It's the most beautiful niggun in the world, by the way. It's a fantastic niggun. And he remembered that part of it. And I sang him the rest. And whenever he came to our house for Shabbos, my kids to this day, my oldest son is already 61 years old. So, but he calls it, our kids who knew him call it the Jonathan Sachs niggun. In our house it was called. But he had an appreciation of Chassidish and the Gunim. There's a radio program in England for the last 70 years probably. It's called Desert Island Discs. Disc, like a record, the old-fashioned records. It was an interview, a half-hour program every week. And the interviewer would ask the person who was prominent, known for, in some field of endeavor, if you were stranded on a desert island and you were allowed to take with you 8 pieces of music, which pieces of music would you choose? And then they would play in the program, in between the sikhas, they would play these 8 things. Not totally, because of copyright laws, but they played snatches of these 8 tunes. And then you also, what object, besides, what book would you take besides the Bible and Shakespeare? And what object, physical object, would you take with you on that desert island? And Jonathan Sachs was interviewed when he was appointed chief rabbi. It's about 35 years ago, and he gave 4 pieces of classical music and 4 Jewish songs, because one of them was the song that they sang in his house every Friday night with his kids. I think it was maybe Osa Shalom. No, it was, we'll come back to me. It was, but of those 4 Jewish songs, he chose Tzoma Lecha Nafshi, My Soul Thirsts For You. It's a song that the Rebbe taught us. And he described in his way, just in 1 or 2 sentences, Kfar Chabad, the yeshiva. He didn't say the word Kfar Chabad. He said he was in a village in central Israel. And on Saturdays, when the sun was going down, in other words, in the evening, they would sing songs some without words, some with words, and they would sing this song. And they played Tzomel Honafshi on the BBC. At the end of the half hour, the interviewer, she asked him, and that it was done every week, if you had a choice of 1 piece of music out of the 8, what would be the one? And he said, it would be Tzoma Lecha Nafshi. He says, that's my epitaph. That's my epitaph, he said. And when he passed away, which was 5 years ago, which was during COVID, it wasn't lockdown, but it was very much, only 30 people. It was an outside place. One of our sons, our second son, he's only 60, but he was on the Chevron Kedisha, so he was one of the people that was there. But I've been to his cave, and on his tombstone, it's just a few lines, but on the bottom it says Tzoma Lecha Nafshi. And they sang that niggun at the funeral. They sang that tune, that he said, I want that to be my epitaph. And his best friend, who was his madrich in Bnei Akiva, is a man by the name of Lionel Rosenfeld. He was a rabbi in England, a bit older than him, you know, he was 6-7 years older, but they were very friendly. They went, their families went together on vacation every summer. They're very close. And I met him a few months ago, and he told me, I heard this before from him. He said, at heart, he was Chabad. That's what he was. And he knew him better than anybody. He said, that's what he was. That's where his whole heart was. And so he had an appreciation. And the Rebbe said, will you have an appreciation for this? He wasn't visibly a chassid, like the rabbi said. He said, the Rebbe never told me to be visibly a chassid. That's how he was justified. But he did tell me more than once that the Jewish community at the beginning, the establishment, the press, not Orthodox, wasn't always such big fans of him. They had to report him when in his earliest years. He outgrew them. But he told me, I'm working with the BBC and the Times, and he had a program on Fridays on the BBC, and once a month he had a column in the London Times, and he says, I'm working, the Rebbe said to work on the Sheva Mitzvahs B'nai Noyach. He probably has reached more non-Jewish people, well into the million, than almost anybody in the world. Than almost any Jew in the world. So he was, you know, a person. So over that summer, he was going back at the end of, this was the beginning of September. It was Chayel, it was a Fabregan of the Rebbe. And the Rebbe said, anybody who's going overseas on a trip, come up and say L'chaim near the Rebbe. The Fabregan was 1,000 people there in the hall. And come up, and maybe they got a bottle of L'chaim. So he came up to say he's leaving. And the Rebbe said to him, why are you leaving? Why don't you stay for Rosh Hashanah? It's less than 2 weeks. So he said, I got to get back to Cambridge. So the Rebbe said to him, the term doesn't start there until 2 weeks later. And he told me, it's one of the last, I heard this from him before, but a few months before he passed away, I was talking to him on the phone, during the COVID time. But he told me, I still have not worked out after all these decades, how did the Rebbe know that Cambridge starts 2 weeks later than all the others? In Cambridge and Oxford, their terms are only 8 weeks each, 3 times a year. All the other universities move 10 weeks. And they start, so he, I don't know how he ever knew. It's, anyway, I don't know if he was planning to go back or not. He has a plane and a reservation, and the Bachrim locked him into the room. And they made him miss his plane. And he stayed for Rosh Hashanah. It was all in good friendship. They all remained good friends. And he was there for Rosh Hashanah. He was there by Tekiyas. And he davened like a good English Ashkenazi 20-year-old with a little talis on his shoulder. And somebody was there. I wasn't there Rosh Hashanah. Since I went to England, I was never in New York Rosh Hashanah. But of course, the Rebbe told me, I went to Yechidus with my wife and our oldest son, who's in California right now, that the Rebbe said, Elul and Tishrei are auspicious times to work with youth. So I never went Rosh Hashanah. But I heard from people that were there, they said he was shortish, he wasn't tall, but he was wiry. He said he kept his place there. It was very hard. And I asked him, how did you manage it? He said, I tried something that nobody else did. I said, what'd you do? I said, excuse me. but Moshe Levy, Rabbi Moshe Levy told me that what he actually said was, what exactly are you trying to achieve? He was telling the people that stopped up by the Rebbe, and his little talis remained on him, and he was there, and he heard Tekiyas. Now, It was 1 year before he passed away on Chav Cheshvid. So 1 year and 1 month before that, he spoke in Marbalash, in the big flagship synagogue in central London. He would speak every year. That was like sort of a contract just for Rosh Hashanah Yom Kippur. And there was a bacha there who asked him for some advice, and he told him to go to me. He said, you know, Shmuelu. He said, yes, yes, go to him. Whatever it was. So this boy came right away, right after Rosh Hashanah, that night, came to my house in London. This is 6 years ago. And he said, Rabbi Sachs told me to come to you and to help him on whatever it was. So I said, tell me, what did he speak about on Rosh Hashanah? What was his sermon about in Marble Arch Synagogue, in that fancy schmancy shul? And he said he spoke about tekiyas by the Rebbe. And he said that shofar by the Rebbe, that's what Rosh Hashanah is about. And if you don't know that, you don't know the real depth of Rosh Hashanah. And you should get a description of it, and then it'll enhance your Rosh Hashanah. That's him speaking to United Synagogue people. No Chabadniks in the shul, except this young man who was the caterer there. Spoke to him. So he was a person who had a very close connection with the Rebbe. The Torah studies came a few years later. I had shim with him, you know, many, many stories, private conversations. I don't want to bore you with all. It's interesting, all of it. It was very brilliant and even whatever. But he was a very, very special person. And he was a very special person in my own career, because my first 10 years was spent, I was teaching. The Rebbe told me you always have to teach. People, my in-laws complained that sometimes I'd come back from a college 3 o'clock in the morning, 4 o'clock, and 9 o'clock in the morning I had to be teaching. I woke up fleshig, many very often. Happened plenty of times. I come at 3 o'clock, have a bite, and have to get up at 8 o'clock, whatever. But the Rebbe said I must always teach, and eventually, the Rebbe told me, then I was in the boys' school, high school for 4 years, and then in the boys' primary school for 2 years, and then I was in the girls' high school for 4 years, because there I could just teach one lesson at a time, like 40 minutes, whatever. But eventually, after 4 years there, the Rebbe told me, two-word answer, become the head. I asked, and he wrote, Hatzal Nachoina, two words. The suggestion is correct. During that time, those 10 years, he was like, in the beginning, I had many, many other students. I had, you know, about 800 students on my mailing list. But he was like one of the earliest. And we went through good times together, you know, a lot of good times. A special person. He's able. I'll tell you another thing I only found out after he passed away. Because they asked me, they were making a big shloshim. There was one international, which I spoke on, for the Far East, based in Hong Kong. But there were hundreds of people on a Zoom call. This was in 2021. His shloshim would be in about November. And they had something in London, and so they had three or four people who were very close to him, and one of them was myself, from the earlier years, of ladies, but one was a woman, I didn't know, so she was his coach. He had a coach to help him to become, to speak English, to be a better speaker. Now, I never met a person who was a master of the language, like he was. We worked on the Torah studies. We spoke about, you know, he told me so many things, like, he says, a minimum of bold and italics in English. The language is versatile enough. He had such a knowledge of English. But he knew he has to learn from someone. And this woman told him what color tie to wear, different things. And what I tell my students, my high school girls, is that you learn from this, that never think that you know everything there is to know about anything. Because this was a person who was a master of the field. But he still had somebody, you could say, to bounce off ideas, whatever it is. It's called a mashpia in Hasidus. It means a mentor, somebody that can help you on your spiritual journey.